Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a
Don Gabor with us. He's the author of How to Start a Conversation and Make Friends. He's a small talk expert, communications trainer, and the author of 10 self-help books and audio programs. Don was a media spokesperson for Sprint, Frito-Lay, Grand Mariner, and is a frequent media guest. He's been featured in hundreds of radio, TV, and print interviews, including 60 Minutes and Andy Rooney. He shows people how to network and use conversation skills to build relationships in business, social, and personal situations. And let's say, Don, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. I guess the old days of walking up to someone and say, hi, what's your sign? That doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, well, I guess it does for some people, not for me. But it is important to go up and show that you do want to meet other people and that you're willing to take the initiative. So that part I agree with. You know, you want to be the first to say hello. That helps get things started.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. And I think that's the major problem, Don, with most people in a conversation. It's how do you start it? Even when the old days with, you know, hi, you know, do you come here often? The point is, it's making that first step and saying something, because I would venture to guess, and I can't prove out the stats on this, but I would venture to guess 90% of the people out there are frightened to death to make that first contact and say those first words.
It seems like that. For the last 30 years, I've been writing and teaching on this subject, that is the big fear that a lot of people have. They're not really sure what to do or what to say. And what I try to tell folks is that, first of all, most people are thinking most about themselves, and they are more worried about what you think of them than what they might be thinking of you. And so if you focus outward towards people and show interest in them, it's the old saying, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. It really can do the trick. The other thing is to just focus on your immediate surroundings and start a conversation with an easy-to-answer question or a lighthearted comment about what's going on around you or the people that maybe you have in common or just some situation. Get the ball rolling and then use your ears to pick up you know, what the other person says, and that can help guide the conversation.
And by the way, where was it for you in communications when you realized that this can and is a problem with a lot of people? What caused you to look at this, hone in on it, do the research, and do the work so you can teach it today?
The first time I really, I was not a shy kid. In fact, I was, you know, often kicked out of my classes for talking. And in fact, I even got accused by one teacher of the first person he knew that could talk and listen at the same time. I took that as a career guidance comment and a compliment. But when I first moved to New York in 1979, I was asked to teach a class on how to start a conversation to adults in a three-hour class format. And so I was always pretty good at talking to people, but I did some research, and I found that people in books would write, you know, go and talk to people or do this or do that, but they never really said how. And so I did a couple months worth of research, and in this group of adults, I started to notice that people asked me the same types of questions. So, and this was a monthly class, so it was in one group each month. And the questions were, you know, how do I break the ice, and what do I say after I say hello, and how do I get the conversation, keep it going, and how do I remember names? So these and how do I end conversations? These these questions just kept coming over and over. And so I knew how I did it, but I wanted to find out really in a more specific and a deeper way some of the communication skills that were involved. And it has evolved for me into a 30-year career. And it's for me, the most interesting part of it is you can't learn enough about how to communicate with people because everyone's different. So you have to be a good conversationalist, you have to be able to be a good listener and then adapt to each person that you're talking to. And so it's something that you can always learn more about.
By the way, Don, I've got your book in my hands, by the way. I'm looking at the back of the book. And one of the things that it says in the back, which is a very interesting point, identify your personal conversation style. And I wonder how many people realize that there are different styles in conversation. And if you don't know yours, how are you going to know anybody else?
You know, everyone's different, and people speak differently, and there's regional differences and cultural differences and age differences. So there's lots of differences in the way people talk to one another. But there are certain things that people have in common, and those styles have been identified for many, many years through different kinds of surveys and questionnaires and so on. And in the book, I have a very short, I think it's 18 questions that help a person kind of identify his or her style. You could have a more outgoing kind of candid style where you just, you know, get to the point, or you have a more talkative style where you kind of like to elaborate on things. Or maybe another one of the four styles is just a little more quiet and introverted, more thoughtful. Good listening skills are involved with those styles. And then there's the technical style, that everything is very logical. People communicate in a very logical way, and they like to make sure that every point is covered. So by taking this very short questionnaire, it kind of helps a person get a sense of how he or she communicates. And once you do that, and you learn some of the strengths and weaknesses of each of those styles, and no person is just one style or really a combination, but it gives you a feeling of which, kind of a sense of which way you like to dance, so to speak. Because I like to think of conversation like a dance, and you have a dance partner. And so if you like to dance fast, then when you meet somebody who likes to dance slow or speak in a slightly different way, then the trick there is to be able to identify what that other person's style is, know a little bit of your own style, and then adapt. And so it takes a little bit of practice, but you'd be surprised how quickly you can begin to identify styles. Plus, certain people gravitate to certain types of jobs and their communication styles, not entirely, but certain communication styles gravitate to certain types of jobs. For example, engineers, my father was an engineer, so I know of what I speak, they tend to be more logical communicators, and they like to speak in specific terms, whereas maybe teachers, because of the nature of their work, they need to get up in front of an audience of students. They tend to be elaborate a little bit more and explain things in a more global way. So those are just two examples. But the point is that once you know your own communication style or a little bit of your nature or your tendency in terms of how you communicate, then you can adapt your style. If you know you can be a little too talkative, then when you meet somebody who's a little quieter, you can tone it down a bit.
Now, by the way, I opened the book up. I'm on page 32. I've already memorized it. And it's got a few hints about...
I have to look and see what's on that page.
I'm a quick learner. Now, by the way, a few hints about dealing with rejection when breaking the ice. I think it's extremely important to bring that up. And I can remember back when I was a kid, it's that embarrassment when you walk up to somebody and you say, do you want to dance? And everybody's staring at you. And she says, no. And you have to kind of crawl away. Now, that's an exaggerated example. But at the same time, Don, there are so many people who are frightened to death to start the conversation because of the potential, the possibility of rejection. So how do we deal with that?
Let me tell you, Michael, about a survey I do in my class. I ask people in the class, just like what you're talking about, I said, how many people here really are reluctant to start the conversation? And in other words, I say, who in this class is the first to, you know, say hello? And nobody raises their hand, or maybe a few. So approximately 70 to 80% of the people are not the ones who are going to start the conversation. And then I ask, how many of you in this group of 30 people or so would be willing, if somebody approaches you in a natural or friendly way, not aggressive or really weird or anything, would be willing to engage that person in conversation if they just approach you in a friendly way? And almost everybody raises their hand. So what this the purpose of this exercise, and to answer your question, is the reality is that most people, if you take the initiative to start a conversation, most people will be happy and pleased that you're the one that broke the ice. And most people will be happy to talk to you. Now, sure, there's going to be one or two, maybe, for whatever reason, who knows, might not be particularly open for conversation. But those are the rare exceptions. So the point here is that most people's fear of rejection is really not based in what is the most likely occurrence, and that is that if you take the initiative, most people will talk to you. Now, there's a couple exceptions. Now, we're talking about, let's say, in a party situation or in a work-related situation, most people are there to communicate, and they will respond, in most cases, positively to you if you approach them in a friendly way. In public, you know, you're walking down the street or you're at a park or in a restaurant, people are going to be a little less open simply because it's a public situation and they don't know who you are and why you're there and maybe why you're approaching them. So, yes, there are chances that you're going to get rejected a little bit more in those places, but I tell people, look, what's the worst thing? So somebody rejects you. So let's say you do get rejected by someone. You know, so what? You don't even know the person. Are you going to let one person's rejection keep you from reaching out to people where 9 out of 10 will probably respond in a positive way? And you put that on top of learning some basic communication skills, good body language, knowing how to break the ice, not with, hey, didn't I see you on the cover of some magazine, which is, you know, a phony baloney line that nobody's going to believe anyway. So you put some communication skills in with a little bit of understanding that the risks are far lower than most shy people realize, and chances are you're going to start to see some positive responses.
No, I want to add something to the mix. At the bottom of the page, it said a philosophical... I can say that word, a philosophical look at rejection when breaking the ice. And if you're rejected when reaching out to people, don't automatically assume it's your fault. Very important, Don, because there's a lot of people who, quote unquote, get rejected. It has nothing to do with them. That person is doing nothing more than projecting themselves. There may be something in you that threatens them because they don't feel that they have it within themselves. So being rejected is not necessarily something that you're doing. It's something coming from that other person, and you may have nothing to do with it. And I think that's a critical point to bring up.
It is. And see, what I try to do, and I'm not a therapist, I'm not a psychologist, I've just been teaching this subject for many, many years, and so my goal is to help people get over what for many is a lifelong problem. And so I try to take away some of the responsibility for things going wrong. You know, sometimes people aren't receptive to conversation, so you can start a conversation or try to start a conversation, and again, it doesn't have anything to do with you. The trick here is to observe people and get a sense if that person that you want to start the conversation with is sending you any kind of receptive signals. So by tuning into other people, tuning into people's body language, watching how they communicate with others, the chances of success are going to increase. But you know, sometimes you just don't know. On the other hand, there are people who've had a really lousy day, and they're really in a bad mood, and something's happened that they just feel rotten. And just somebody else coming up with a friendly smile and hello can be the first positive thing that's happened to that person in the day, and it can make a big difference in that person's life. So, you know, I've had people say, you know, thanks for saying hello. You know, you're the first friendly face I've seen today. And just something that simple can you know, make a person's day feel a lot better, and it's a great reason to try and start the conversation.
Sure. No question about it. And I realistically believe that if we can get outside of ourselves and take a look at the world around us and begin to realize that everything that we do does not cause rejection somewhere, I think that's the first step of moving forward. Communication skills are critically important. And what it really boils down to, it's not what you say, it's what they hear within the words of what you say that's going to cause that. And it gets this confusing. If you want to break down a word, you take the word, which you have the dictionary definition, then you got the connotation, which is the meaning, plus the emotional impact. You got the verbal content, face value, and the nonverbal content, the underlying meaning. And then what you have is one more thing, and you mentioned it, it's the state of mind of the receiver. You walk into the room and you look at your wife and you say, boy, you look good today. And she says, thank you. She's in a good mood. She's not in a good mood. Boy, you look good today. What do you want to do about it? So
you know, the thing, what you say, Michael, is absolutely true. In the end, people form conclusions about one another based on a whole lot of things. And sometimes they can break it down like you just did. And sometimes it's just the feeling that washes over them. So if you approach people in an open and friendly way and you engage and you show that you have interest in the person, it's not just about you, it's about them. At the end of the conversation, even if it's a 2-minute or 5-minute or 10-minute, however long it lasts, the person says to him or herself, you know, I kind of like that person. You know, she seemed friendly to me. She seemed interested. She laughed when I made a little joke. I like her. And that's kind of how quickly we form our opinions about people. On the other hand, if you don't ask some questions and you don't share a little bit of information about yourself or you don't take the initiative, people will form the opposite opinions about a person like that. And that's why shy people sometimes get a bum rap, because people think that they're aloof or uninterested or snobbish or a whole bunch of other, you know, negative labels, when in fact they may not be that way at all, but because they have not shown some initiative, people will they will arrive at a negative impression of them. And this is unfair, but that's the way it is. And that's why in the book, How to Start a Conversation and Make Friends, my goal here is to help people connect, find common interests, explore the interests of one another. What makes this person interesting? What makes him or her different? Where do we share some values, some common interests, some common goals? And once that connection is made, it's all about making that connection. Then there's an opportunity to build on that relationship, whether it be a friendship or a business relationship or even more. But without the initial conversation, nothing happens.
Now, by the way, Don, we're starting to run out of time, but what one or two things do happen, and this is why I think the kind of training you have is extremely important. You and I meet. One of two things are going to happen the minute I meet you. I'm going to get an adrenaline rush or a dopamine rush. Based on what I see and hear, it's going to cause a chemical reaction in my body, and it's either going to be safe or unsafe. And I'm going to respond to how that unconscious part of me is projecting outwardly, and you have nothing to do with it. It's all in me, or vice versa. It's the same. So realistically, there's an entire dynamic that occurs when you meet somebody and those first couple of words come out of their mouth or not. That's what I think is critical. And with that, Don, mm-hmm. do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure. It's dongabor.com. My name, DonGabor, like Jaja, .com. And I've been presenting this kind of material to individuals and businesses for 30 years. I just did a conference on networking up in Canada and up in Connecticut, down in Florida, to associations. So everybody needs and wants to be better at talking to people, and how to start a conversation and make friends can help.
Wonderful. Hey, Don, thank you so much for joining us.
Michael, thank you for inviting me on your show.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me?
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sherry Edwards with us. Innovative, informative, inspiring. She's an original thinker. She's imaginative, entertaining, and most important, thought-provoking. She has the ability to provide an extraordinary glimpse into the medicine of the future through use of, listen to the words, vocal profiling and individuated sound presentation. And Sherry, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we talk about sound profiling, our entire bodies are made up of vibrational sounds. So in essence, if you can hear me, can you basically break me, when I say break me down and tell me what's good, bad, or indifferent based on that vibration, the combination of, that comes out of me. Sherry, you still there? Well, that was a good question. I guess. Seth, I think we lost Sherry. I heard a noise. Okay, Sherry, do we have... Okay. All right, but realistically, when you think about it, and I haven't studied or researched the subject, when she comes back, your body, your mind is an electrochemical factory, and it creates vibration. And that vibration in and of itself, if you've got homeostasis, if you have balance, you're moving in the way that you should. If the vibrations are off, it would seem to me, and I'm not a clinician, so don't take this one to the bank, but it seemed to me if your vibrations were off, there would be a disconnect. And if there is a disconnect, then it's going to cause a problem internally. And if it causes a problem internally, then obviously you're going to get the external consequence. So wouldn't it be interesting if the medicine of the future was based on your vocal tones, your vibrations? Sherry, do we have you back?
Yes, and I was listening to your question when we got cut off. You have something going on in your voice that not very many people have. You have the ability to meet somebody else exactly where they are. What they say and how they say it, you meet them there. I did 3 profiles of you before going on the show, and I can tell where you're coming from, what you're interested in, what your intention is. Even listening to your last guest about communication, Don, I can pretty much tell you what his vocal profile is going to be like. He is a helper person. He will give and give and give and give, even if it hurts, and he wants absolutely successful physical outcomes from you. Having that kind of information about someone else gives you a leg up on how they communicate. Only we're doing it with a computer program. You don't have to guess anymore. You don't have to take a questionnaire. And we want to give it away to your audience.
Wonderful. Now, by the way, when we are dealing with this, when we got lost for a minute, and I'm not a clinician, so I just got a feel, and this is what I said in essence, so stop me if I'm wrong, please, that we're an electrochemical factory, and we also create certain vibrations. If the vibrations are in balance, homeostasis and balance, things work and we're fine. But if the vibrations are off, that will cause internal and external problems. Also, if you're at a certain vibration, then you can basically define what a person is like based on that entire makeup of who they are and why they are inside. Am I close here?
You're absolutely correct. I have a 5-page printout of you just from a demo tape that I looked up on the internet. And we could take this show and find out exactly how you felt about your guest before, how you're feeling today, maybe even what you ate, what nutrients you need, but what your intentions are and where you're going with something. Think about somebody going on a date and they look on their iPhone and, okay, this person has the note of E, so, and it's big and they're just awk, and, or they have the note of C, so they're all ego. So you can see where that person is coming from before you ever start that conversation with them.
Well, which makes a lot of sense, which does this. It takes the unknown completely and totally out of it. And I think that's the biggest problem that most of us have as a human race. We're frightened to death of the unknown. There's that old adage, better be unhappy than unsure.
Perfect.
Yeah. And what would happen if
perfect way to look at it.
Yeah. And what would happen if I knew? Which obviously it would put a whole different slant on everything. Where did you come up with this?
If you knew, what's the point of knowing everything about somebody before you meet them? Is this person compatible with you? Okay, maybe they are, and it's a dull life. But if they aren't compatible, and there's a little fight going on, maybe that's what you want. So you can see what's happening, but you can look at your children. You can look at somebody you're going into business with. You know how they communicate. You are a combination of the thinker and the emotion person. Very seldom do you ever move beyond that in any of the interviews I've ever seen you. Sometimes you flip from left brain to right brain, from intellect, but you're very consistent in that you think everything first. And things that are important to you, you bring in your emotions. Things that are not, you keep it intellectual. But at the same time, you meet the person where they are. That's a very special talent.
You know, it's kind of interesting with it that as you're speaking, this is what I'm starting to hear also, and that what you've done. There obviously there's something called an empathic. They're somebody who talks to you, and they actually become you as they're talking to you, so they know exactly how to respond back and forth. What I'm hearing, and Sherry, stop me if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing is that you've taken that empathic ability and you've put it on software.
Yes, that's a great way to explain it. And not only that, we're providing it to your audience for free.
No, I know. Got that loud and clear. Now, how do we find it?
Nano, N-A-N-O, which means little, nanovoice.com, and you can download it. There's charts right there you can download. There's an instruction booklet, and we don't ask for anything. Just go get it. This is our gift to the world. We think it's very important that you know what somebody else's motivation is. But more than that, what is your motivation? Is this the right job? It can tell you. Is this the right relationship? It can tell you.
Oh, okay. Now, by the way, when you found it, how did you find it? With all the work you've done, how did you find this? Where was it that this clicked and you went, oh, the cathartic moment, that aha moment that you did, that you said, this is it?
I have hearing that's very different from other humans. My ear bones are constructed differently. And I heard this from people all my life, plus other things. And then my undergraduate degree is in interpersonal communication. And I was very interested in communication style. Do you want to talk about facts or emotions or the future or what we're going to do together? And so in doing a lot of questionnaires with people and matching it to what I was hearing in their voice, we were able to create the program.
Now, by the way, when you talk about intercommunication skills, I guess you heard the very last piece with Dawn, that the skills in and of themselves, they're tied to body reactions and they're tied to chemicals. You and I meet, something's going to happen in a millisecond. I'm either going to protect myself or feel completely safe, and it's all what your body chemistry will do. And that in and of itself is a strong part of communication that usually is left underneath the surface and we're not aware of. If you're aware of that, tied together with what you offer, my goodness, look what there's no ceiling to it.
We can put it together. You were talking about dopamine and adrenaline. Dopamine feeling very, very safe. That person is going to express a D sharp, and all this comes up in notes, like in a song. So if they're expressing D sharp, they feel safe. If they're expressing F sharp, there's two things here. One is adrenaline, and the other is sex.
Yeah. Got it. No, loud and clear.
Loud and clear. See where they're going.
Yeah, but what I'm hearing also is that most of this has been done accidental. What you've done is you've made it intentional. You've created a whole scenario, and you've created a way that people can be intentional in what they do, and you can almost predict an outcome if you do this right.
Absolutely correct. You can't lie with the frequencies of your voice, the vibration. You can lie with your words, but the vibrations are what we pick up, and that's what tells us the absolute intention of what was going on. We could have saved the government billions because we knew that Gaddafi was going to stand and fight. This was not going to be any little weak skirmish. We knew his intention before it ever came out into the public what was going to happen. So people can do this from the top down and look at all their government officials and what's going on. And we've done things on why Trump decided to run for president and why Jesse Ventura did. Well, why all of them are.
Yeah.
And we can see who's going to win and what their issues are. But it's more important, I think, but this is my opinion, that people get to know themselves. And they can talk to this. It just punch a bunch of buttons, and it just flip out the report. You don't have to do much at all. And then you can know, am I supposed to take this job or this job? Is my kid lying to me? And you can see when people have notes of E and A sharp that are not balanced, and that's all in the little booklet, they're lying to you. They're withholding information. How important is that for to go through your life?
Well, sure, absolutely. You know, and my feeling is that, you know, you get to a certain point in life where vulnerability is one of your most potent tools. And the reason for that is that if you're not hiding anything, it can't be used against you. So it's called open it up and be vulnerable, because when you do that, you become very powerful.
Very, very powerful. It's very strengthful, because if you don't have anything to hide, you can be exactly who you are.
You mean I'm going to go there and I'm going to find out who I am finally, huh?
You can if you want, or I will send you all of these reports I did on you already.
Well, send the reports. You know, we'll do the which would be great, and then I'll go look at it too, and then we'll come back on, because I don't mind breaking it down. If you want to break down some of it, we can right now. It's fine with me.
Well, you have a very strong sense of justice about our security. That is the strongest point in your voice.
No, okay,
whatever
that means.
Subject. Pardon?
I said, that means what?
That you want things to be fair and upfront, just, and you can be very, very stubborn about that idea, and you will actively work toward that. But that is consistent in every one of your charts, that you are justice-oriented.
You know, by the way, absolutely, and I would venture to guess that it came from where I grew up, the time frame that I grew up, and who my heroes were at the time. John Wayne will always live in my life.
Yes, justice, hero.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and the older I get to take a look at what we're starting to lose in this country, and it is the justice, and it is the hero, and I don't know what direction we've taken, but I think one of the things that you have to offer, if they would just take a look at it, and go from there. You're right. The billions of dollars it could have saved if they would have known what Gaddafi was going to do before he was going to do it. But there is one, I think the biggest challenge that you have with all of this as regards to that, are dollars. And when I say it's dollars, when it comes down to it, somebody is making money based on what happens in this world. And that's where the main challenges and the fights are.
I agree.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
With this little program, and we're giving it away for free, and people say, oh, free, that, you know, it can't be all that good. But, you know, when Oprah gave away keys to cars to every audience member, they loved it.
Sure.
So we're here to give to your audience something that's just as valuable. It's going to last a lifetime. And it's my gift to the world. We have other things going on, but this is my gift to the world because I feel like our government is lying to us. They're lying to us about radiation. They're lying to us about the wars. And this is a way that people can look at what the truth is and begin to stand up and say, I've had enough.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm trying to start trouble.
Oh, and by the way, I'll be happy to go pick a fight with them for you and with you. So I'm on your side. and there's no way that I'm not. Okay, now, I get the profile. And you're going to send me the, what, 5 pages or whatever it is? You can email it to us.
You want me to email it to you right now?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that would be good. Let me give you an email address.
Okay.
It's Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L,
okay.
dot... Dresser, D-R-E-S-S-E-R,
okay,
at S-B-C, Sam Baker Charlie, S-B-C Global, G-L-O-B-A-L, .net.
Okay.
Yeah, don't tell anybody what the email address is. That's between us.
Okay. I will send it right over. It's not in final form, just a lot of pieces.
Yeah. Now, see, I think this would be great to look at. Because, you know, on a personal level, if I see it, and so far everything you've said I completely agree with, that that we can talk about it more and get more and more people involved in it and being able to do it. Now, what else are you guys doing?
We are doing a project on radiation, and we're giving away that radiation software. I'm trying to talk and type at the same time.
Okay.
So that people can help us set up an early warning system. So let's say there's 10 people in San Francisco who have strontium in their voice. So we can say that area has been inundated with strontium, and so we can tell people that that antidote is glutathione and their zinc is going to be in stress. So we're giving away the software and at the same time giving away charts so that people, as we see, can give this back to us and we'll put a net work together, map. If some of these words are spelled wrong, it's because I can't type and think
That's okay.
at the same time.
I can't read, so together we'll get through this.
Okay, I'm attaching the file now. The other one we're doing is Parkinson's. And we either do it for people or we teach them to do it. But we've been able to get rid of the tremors. We had one lady in that had facial paralysis, give them more energy, help them swallow better. So there's a lot going on there with that big project. We finished one with the Army on traumatic brain injury. So a lot of things going on here at the Research Center.
Sherry, let me hold you up for a minute because we're just about out of time. Two things. One is, before we close it off, one is, I'm going to get this. We'll go through it. And if there's a cleaner one, just send it to me, and then we'll have you back on the air, and we'll break it down.
Great.
Yeah.
It's on its way to you. You should have it by now.
Okay. And then for anybody else, it's nanovoicecharts.com.
Nanovoice.org.
Oh, nanovoice.org.
Or they can write to me at Sherry, S-H-A-R-R-Y, on air, at Gmail. And I will get them to the right class and the right information. Because there's all kind of free classes supporting this for people.
Yeah, Sherry, what were you doing about 5, 6, 8 years ago? What was the project?
Oh, macular degeneration, cholesterol, arthritis.
Was there anything with sleep?
Yes, we did a project on sleep.
Yeah. Okay.
We're constantly doing projects. Anxiety, adrenal burnout, methylation, heart stuff. We're constantly we're a nonprofit research center in Ohio, the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology. So we're constantly doing projects and providing that information to the public and training doctors or anybody who wants to train on how to take this to their community.
I think what we'll do is, if you're willing to do this, and I'll have Radio Susie get a hold of you with it, we should do a whole series on this.
That would be great.
You got it. Okay.
All right.
And remember, justice for all. Hey,
yes.
Thank you so much for being with us. But she'll get a hold of you. We'll do a series.
Okay. We'll talk later.
Okay. Good night.
Bye.
They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. I got my gang up there barking away, and that's a great intro for our next guest. Jane Penley with us. She's the author of Hooper Finds the Family, a Hurricane Katrina dog's survival tale. Jane's involved a career as she's enjoyed a career as a writer, an independent documentary producer. She was director of community relations for ABC Television, and her ABC Notebook educational programs were awarded an Emmy and a National Education Association Award. And as a partner in Paley Price Productions, she wrote and produced numerous family-oriented programs for HBO, PBS, and Lucasfilm, among others. And she's an assistant professor in the Division of Mass Communication at St. John's University in Queens, New York. And let us say, Jane, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Happy to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much. You know, they didn't start until I picked the book up. And if you can hear the background, they're barking.
I can.
And that's
what kind of dog?
Oh, there's three of them. One is a lab shepherd mix. He's about 105 pounds. The other one is she's a shepherd, about 90% shepherd. She's about 85-90 pounds. And the other one, him, is a he's got shepherd in him. He's got blue heeler, and he's got everything, a wolf in him. I'm almost positive. And they're wonderful. If you're outside looking in, I wouldn't walk in this house. But once you got in, they would bring you to the refrigerator. They make you a cup of coffee. You know, they're wonderful. And they get along with the four cats.
Oh, wow. You have a menagerie.
I know. Sometimes you walk through, you have to laugh. The dogs will be standing there, and the cats will walk underneath them. Now, they're a family. They're all good together.
Great.
Hooper. What happened with Hooper? Yes.
Hooper is a healing dog, a wonderful dog that we had the good fortune to adopt, because I went online. A lot of people go online and they meet their husbands or wives or partners. I went online and our family found a dog.
Wow.
So this is his story. He is, to the best of our knowledge, a Katrina survivor. He was a puppy. He was found by a volunteer, brought to a shelter. And by dint of communication online, we decided to adopt him. And so we began this very interesting journey. We rendezvoused with the woman, wonderful woman who fostered him in Richmond, Virginia. And he started out as a good old boy from Louisiana, and now he's not only a New Yorker, but he's a Yankee fan.
Now, by the way, I have the book. I'm opening up to the back page. How do you not fall in love with that face?
We did. We fell in love online. That's exactly right.
And by the way, when it comes to dogs, you know, a Hurricane Katrina dog survival tale, I want to go back to the last page where it says acknowledgments. There would be no Hooper without Labs for Rescue. And I think that's a very important thing to talk about. Who are they and what are they responsible for?
Well, they are, like many rescue organizations, devoted to finding homes for Labrador retrievers. And as you may know, that is a very popular breed around the United States. So there are many. There are many litters that are turned out and need homes. And this organization, which is headquartered in Connecticut, but works up and down the East Coast. In fact, I was chatting with somebody from the organization yesterday, and I learned that there were over 5,000 labs who found homes in the Connecticut area in which we live. And what is so special about this organization, and I mean, I don't have experience with any other, but I can tell you that they really are meticulous about matching a family with a dog. And that means, literally, that those who want to adopt have to fill out a very, very complicated, not complicated, that's not right, a long form about lifestyle, about how much time families have to spend with dogs, about whether there is a yard, whether the dog will be exercised a whole lot. And they do an analysis, a very careful analysis of what kind of dog will suit what kind of family. And so when I wrote and poured my heart out because we had recently lost a dog to cancer and were devastated, and you know you're a dog and cat owner, losing a pet is a very traumatic life experience.
It's one of the kids.
Sorry?
I said it's one of the kids.
Absolutely. You couldn't be more right. And you know, you go through a period where you think, oh, I could never love a dog like I loved my dog. And this is an organization that is very sensitive to understanding what it's like to readjust to a new dog. And so they do a matching process that's very effective. And in our case, this wonderful, wonderful dog came to us, and with the a little note about his talents as a healer. And I know that sounds to people who don't own animals like kind of a new age crazy thing, but in point of fact, animals are very, very sensitive to us.
Sure.
And they really do fit in when it's right. They really do become family members in a very significant kind of way. So we looked at this dog, and, you know, he didn't look like our old dog. And was he going to fit in, and was he going to get us, and were we going to get him, and was he going to sort of appreciate the way we live? And all that stuff that sounds crazy, but you do think about when you're admitting a new creature into your home.
You know what I would have changed in the book? I would have changed one thing in the book. On page 134, where it's got, you know, his first day in New York City, underneath it, I would have said that with the look on his face, I would have had a caption. And the caption would have said, "You talking to me?"
I'm sorry, I didn't think of that. but he did. He was horrified. I mean, he was very scared of the noise and the... Just, you know, he was a country boy, and here he was being introduced to a very noisy, I don't know if he perceived the hostility and the energy, both the positive and the negative aspects of New York, but he caught on, and he caught on in a marvelous sort of way, and he gets our sense of humor, and we get his sense of humor, and all the rest. So it's an action-adventure story, but it's also a love story.
Sure. How could it not be? And when you look at his face, there's a lot of gentleness in that face, but there's also a lot of playfulness in the face. And the picture in the back with the two of you on the back cover, if I look at that, the first thing that hits me is there's wisdom in him.
Mm-hmm.
And there is it's an innate wisdom, and as innocent as he is, it's the healing wisdom that you talked about.
Absolutely. And what we learned about him early on was that he established a rapport very easily with children. When we started walking him around the neighborhood, he would make eye contact with kids and sometimes just sit down and invite interaction. And that was one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because in a way, you know, when you have a dog, you have a three-year-old forever. And he loves kids of all ages. He loves going to libraries and schools. And, you know, last week we were visited a first grade class, and all the kids lined up to pet him. You know, there were some dogs who would just, you know, not me, thanks very much. But he just loved it. He made eye contact with all of them, and his tail was wagging. I mean, he is a healer, no question about it.
Yeah, Jane, when you really look at it and look at dogs and you think about that entire world, that's one of the reasons I cannot go to a shelter. I can't walk into one. I don't have the strength or the heart to be able not to tear up and grab three of them and take them home. But the point of contention is this. If you can tell what somebody's like based on their experience and their feeling towards animals, because there's a communication that goes on with an animal. They don't physically talk, but my goodness, if they don't understand you, then I don't know anything. There are times when I'll say something to the dogs, and they actually follow through with what I'm talking about. And the big one, who's 105 pounds, he's still a big baby, and he wouldn't know anything different than anybody loving him and petting him. And that's what I think that all animals should be like. Of course, we don't have that. There are a lot of horror stories. And that's one of the things I just can't, for the life of me, imagine anybody mistreating an animal.
You know, I couldn't agree more, obviously. But I would add this thought that we do hear too many of those stories. And I think kids who are subject in their daily lives as they grow up to all kinds of cruelty deserve a story that doesn't stress that really focuses on the positives. The idea, and this has been sort of thematic on your show tonight, the idea of overcoming obstacles and of being vulnerable and taking chances. And I mean, you know, some of the very interesting things about being frightened of the unknown and being afraid of rejection are things that kids live with all the time. And the reason why there are therapies with dogs is because dogs are non-judgmental. As you pointed out, in most cases, they want to give love and they want to get love in return. And if kids can appreciate that empathy and they can actually look at the book as a metaphor for their own lives, which is, you know, schoolyard bullies and getting parental approval and getting teacher approval and being happy, potentially happy adults because they can overcome obstacles. And that's really the story in this book of a puppy who overcomes all of these things because he has hope and he has a positive perspective.
And let me add something to that. The dogs, cats, but dogs for the most part, they're the closest thing to the term unconditional love that you'll ever get next to. We hear about it, but you'll find that within the dog world. The other thing with the being a hurricane survivor, one of the things that I've learned in my life over all of these years is basically this, that the worst challenges that you have, if you have what it takes to get through the challenge, there's a prize at the end of the rainbow. The challenge in and of itself is a gift if you allow yourself to see through it and realize how you can grow and move forward with it. I have seen time and again people with challenges. Maybe somebody died. Maybe there was an accident. Maybe they were disfigured. And what they've done with that and the way that they put it into humanity and helped other people, sometimes those challenges can be absolute legacies.
You couldn't be more right. I agree, and that was one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I really felt that if kids could see that a puppy in a storm could survive, that kids themselves could overcome as well, whatever challenges came their way. But they have to have the confidence and they have to have the support, and they have to have the belief in themselves. So I agree with you completely.
Oh, and by the way, aren't we all puppies in the storm?
We sure are, and that never goes away.
At one time or another. Let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at, and where can we buy the book?
The website is www.janepaley.com, and I have a listing of all of the booksellers who carry the book, the e-book as well. And it's a book that I hope parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles will read with their littler kids, and that middle schoolers will read it themselves. But it is really a book for anybody who loves dogs, any age.
And symbolically, it's not about dogs, it's about the human race.
That's exactly right. But anybody interested in adopting a yellow or a chocolate or a black Labrador retriever or a mix can go to www.labs4rescue.com.
Wonderful.
That's on my site as well.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael. Bye.
Take care. Good night. In a
trance, you fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own, and I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own, hallelujah. I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jamie Kalman with us, certified hypnotherapist with the National Guide of Hypnotists, certified spiritual healer with Healing in America, certified life coach in relationships, spirituality, and life path, health and wellness and prosperity and personal power with the Miracle Center of California. And let us say, Jamie, hi, welcome to the show. If you're there. You're not here. Okay. Is she going to be here? That's a good question. Seth, the magic angel of healing and curing. Push a button.
Healing.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you too.
And each and every night we're going to bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Mike Hallmeyer back with us. It is the It's the Law segment of the Dresser After Dark. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Michael Ray. Great to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Michael, when we look at what's going on today, I want to go to bed and I want to hide and I don't want to get up for another maybe a year and a half. I don't quite understand what's going on in the world today. And with all due respect, and we've discussed this before, there are attorneys I love and there are attorneys who are attorneys that for some reason that they're the people running the government and they shouldn't be there because they don't have that savvy, that wisdom of somebody who's been out there and knows how to run a business. And that's what the government has become. Cash in, cash out business.
It's really sad, and it's even worse than that. Not only are people enriching themselves at the expense of the rest of the folks, but the rest of the folks are prohibited from enriching themselves through getting the results of their own hard work. It's just not right on both of those grounds.
No, no question about it. There was something that came through today, and I'll shoot it to you sometime during the week, but it's the they've just uncovered taxpayer dollars going to create internet exposure to some of the Middle Eastern countries where there are terrorists there. We have people starving here. We have people losing their homes, and we are giving billions of dollars away. The other thing is if we're going to pull out of Afghanistan, that's one thing. But I have to take a look at it through these eyes. During the Second World War, thank goodness he did this, by the way, Hitler didn't let his generals run the war. He took the power away.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. Many exciting and wonderful places, mountains, jungles, and desert oases.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk. That's what it is on Dresser After Dark. Jamie Kalman with us, certified hypnotherapist with the National Guild of Hypnotists, certified spiritual healer with Healing in America, certified life coach in relationships, spirituality, and life path, and health and wellness and prosperity and personal power with the Miracle Center of California. Jamie, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm fine, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we talk about hypnotherapy, and there's so many people that are confused about literally what that is. So when you deal with somebody, when you hypnotize them, quote-unquote, what actually happens? What causes a person to respond under those conditions?
I'm really glad that you asked that question, because that's probably one of the most frequently asked questions that I get when people call and they want to find out what hypnosis is and how it can help them. There's been so many misconceptions about what it is and that it's this Bengali mind control, and it really isn't that at all. Hypnosis is a really peaceful technique that allows people to make changes that they want to make, because it is a combination of deep relaxation, concentration, and imagination. So it's really, hypnosis itself is just a state of heightened suggestibility. So what we do, your question was, how do we put someone in that state and how do we help them get there? Well, we use certain inductions, which are relaxation techniques that allow people to become very calm, very peaceful, and that allows that analytical conscious mind that's always judging and always making so much noise to become very calm and very quiet, and that allows us to connect your subconscious mind, which is the part of your mind that recalls everything that's ever happened to you, with your higher mind, which is that place of infinite possibility and wisdom, so that you can start to really create positive changes through positive suggestion.
Okay, now let me ask you, by the way, where does a person get trained to do this kind of work?
Well, there's a lot of different schools that teach hypnosis and certified hypnotherapy. I'm with the National Guild of Hypnotists, which is one of the oldest of the guilds, and there are teachers who have been trained through the guild to certify others in becoming certified hypnotists, consulting hypnotists, hypnotherapists. There's also, I'm in California, actually, and there's a school here called HMI, which is one of the oldest accredited institutions as well. So there's a lot of different programs.
I always
recommend that people go somewhere where there's an extended program, where there's a guild behind it, because hypnosis is really something that can be a profoundly healing tool. You just really want to know how to do it and be certified by people who are really in their integrity and really know what they're doing.
Now, Jamie, let me ask you this. Did you go to HMI?
You know, I actually met with HMI, and because I was looking for a school that had really strong credentials, and I really liked HMI, knew people who had gone there. But I was so inspired by the Miracle Center of California, which was actually quite a bit farther away from me. It's located in Anaheim, California, and I'm in Los Angeles. So HMI was much closer. But the Miracle Center, what I loved about it was it offered all the same, all of the same credentials that HMI did, but it had a spiritual lean. And I really liked that because I actually incorporate a lot of spirituality into the work that I do. So it was just a better fit for me.
Yeah. I was just curious. Isn't spirituality in and of itself the core of everything anyway? If you want to wear, the title of being Christian, being Jewish, being Buddhist, being something, at the essence, at the very base, isn't spirituality really the key to all of it?
Well, you know, one of my all-time favorite quotes, and I'm sure you've heard this a lot, is that we're not human beings having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a human experience.
Yeah.
And to me, that just sums it up. So I have the honor of being able to work with people of all different spiritual beliefs and philosophies. And, you know, I just work with them where they are because I think that really for me, you know, it is all about spirituality. But I really respect people who, you know, maybe they're not as comfortable with certain spiritual terms, so I can always use terms that are more comfortable for them. But really, for me, it just always comes down to that we're coming from a place of love and possibility. So however that shows up for them and however I can meet them there, that's the way that we do it.
Yeah, possibility is a very powerful word. And I think the word love in and of itself, that most people have to get an anchor for that. I would imagine people coming into you that haven't found love, et cetera, or having particular problems behaviorally or whatever, have no idea what love is. And because if you're not grounded in it, if you don't have that sense of it inside you, you can't recognize it externally. And if you can't recognize it, you're never going to find it.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because the way that I use the term love is not necessarily in that romantic sense of love, which I hear that that's not really the way that you're saying it
either. I love my dog. Wait, I love my dog.
Yes, I know. I love my cat. But it's really that sense of unconditional, creative, infinite energy and love really being a sense of being. So it's beyond just the romantic. And I think that when we are searching for anything in our lives, whether it's the perfect career, the right relationship, whatever it is, a better state of health, what we're really looking for is how can I love myself today? How can I love my life today? And that was what compelled me to do what I'm doing. Because I went through so many profound transformations in my own life using these tools. And it just spoke to me, and I realized this is my purpose. My purpose is to inspire and nurture healing and awareness in others so that they can live lives that they love. Because it's absolutely vital that we do that. That's how we change the world.
By the way, I haven't heard, I've got your press release in front of me, and I used to have it, and I don't know what happened to it. I moved one day, and it disappeared on me. But A Course in Miracles. A Course in Miracles is very powerful. And I haven't heard that in many, many years now.
Yeah, I love A Course in Miracles. It's one of my favorite tools in terms of undoing the fear of my mind and really returning to that state of inner peace and that memory of love. Love in that infinite, vast, unconditional sense.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. That's another
area that most people have a hard time reaching. And it's that word unconditional. We live our lives through many conditions. And, you know, if you love me, you're this way. If life is good to me, it's got to be that way. And I think getting rid of those walls, those defenses, those things that actually stop you from experiencing yourself is one of the most powerful things that you can do.
I agree. And, you know, it's interesting because A Course in Miracles is, it's radical. You know, it really is completely different in what it's talking about, who it's asking us to be, what it's challenging us to aspire to and you know, live in the world is so different from the world that we understand, because it's talking about unconditional love, a lack of judgment, you know, defenselessness, that there's nothing to fear, that there's only love, that, you know, God is love. And, you know, those of us walking in the physical world, we're constantly seeing evidence to the contrary of that. So it really does challenge you to do a little bit of, you know, mental gymnastics around it, because you have to be open to hearing what it is offering you, which is a shift in perception. And that shift in perception is the miracle. That's when we stop looking at something through the eyes of fear and we begin to see it through the eyes of love, where we forgive something, where we are able to be compassionate to something where perhaps before we would have been in judgment. So it's just a powerful tool, but it's absolutely a miraculous piece of work, and I must use it every day in my life.
Oh, sure.
I really
now,
like
by
it.
The way, somebody 35 years ago, maybe 36, 37 years ago, said something to me about hypnosis, because the definition of hypnosis. It was very interesting. What he said to me was that a hypnotist's job is not to hypnotize, but it's to dehypnotize, bring down the level of receptiveness and sensitivity to the world, because it seems as though we walk around in a hypnotic, suggestive state, and unless we can shore ourselves up against that, there's a problem. So is hypnosis really something that you bring somebody into or you bring somebody out of?
I love that question. That's amazing. Nobody's ever phrased it to me that way before. And I really like that, because I think you really hit on something, which is that, you know, there's a beautiful passage in the beginning of one of Eckhart Tolle's books, The Power of Now. He wrote a meditation book called Stillness Speaks. And he has a little introduction in there where he says, you know, the role of the spiritual teacher is not to teach anything or give anything. It's to help remove all the layers of falseness from a person's being. It's really to remove all the blocks to the awareness of the presence of love, which is actually, I'm mixing in a little bit of Course in Miracles in that quote. Sure. There. But I agree with you. I think that hypnosis works in two ways. In one way, hypnosis and other healing modalities as well, such as EFT, NLP, energy healing, they all work together to really help somebody let go of the blocks that they're carrying to their true potential, to their worth, to who they really are. And what's beautiful about hypnosis is that because you're very relaxed and you're very open, you can actually apply auto-suggestion, which are, you know, affirmations, positive suggestions for someone, that because they're calm and quiet, they're more receptive to it, and their subconscious mind is really able to just absorb it. So you're really removing what is not true about this person and then offering them the tools and ideas and concepts that move them closer to the truth of who they are.
Now, by the way, if we're dealing with that, the unconscious mind in and of itself deals with the language of pictures and symbols. It doesn't speak a language. And once something gets into that unconscious mind, it takes it on as a goal to achieve. Doesn't know the difference between right or wrong. It gets in there based on symbolic interpretation, and it moves from there. There is a filtering system between conscious and unconscious. It's an inhibitory process. It's an analytical sense of evaluation. And when too many things are coming in at one time, that breaks down and things pour right into the unconscious mind. That's what you talk about when you talk about neuromarketing and neuroimaging. It's used constantly every day in every way, shape, and form. And by the way, ask me who that was that said that to me about hypnosis.
Who was that?
Funny you should ask that, Alex. it was John Kappas.
John Kappas.
John Kappas. Look up who that is.
And he said this to you.
Yeah. Do you know who John is or was?
You know, I don't know very much about John Kappas, I have to be honest.
Okay. John Kappas, no, John Kappas and Alex Kappas, they were brothers. They were the ones who created HMI.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? Actually, that's very interesting because I know exactly who you're talking about because I was doing an exposition once and a gentleman came to me who asked me if I knew John Kappas and then he told me about HMI. So that just brought it full circle for me.
Yeah, no, it was John 30, 35 years ago. Now, he and Alex had passed away, you know, years ago. But that was when HMI wasn't on Ventura Boulevard. It was over in Panorama City. It was the very first place.
Right, that's in Havana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe it was 100 years ago.
It was at that expo that I actually met our mutual friend, the lovely and amazing Pepper J.
Oh, yeah. Okay, sure. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So now I'm doing the motivational chat show with her. She actually brought me on to Actors Entertainment. It's the Actors E-Chat show. She brought me on as a guest on New Year's Eve, actually, just this past December 31st, to talk about how I've been offering hypnosis and EFT to actors, because I am here in Los Angeles, and I have a background in acting as well. And so she brought me on for that, and we talked about hypnosis and EFT for the artist and how it works to help them really remove blocks to their own self-expression and confidence. And now I'm actually co-hosting with John Michael Ferrari the Motivational Chat Show every Wednesday.
So wonderful. Really cool. I can see how you and Pepper J get along. You hypnotize him and she sues him.
We are the dynamic duo, let me tell you.
That's great. We met in Los Angeles. There was some big thing going on. As a matter of fact, it was at the Dodger Stadium. That's where it was originally.
Oh, my gosh.
It was a whole thing. By the way, I think hypnosis, if used properly, what I'm listening to you here, what I'm hearing is a combination of Course in Miracles, hypnosis, and I also hear some Est in there, too.
Well, you know, I did actually go through the Landmark Curriculum for Living years ago. I did their whole program and found it to be really, really interesting. And, you know, one of the things that I've noticed, and you've probably noticed this too from everything that you've, you know, explored and looked into, is that a lot of these different philosophies and ideas, they're all saying the same things. They just use different words. Or just different techniques or different concepts. But I think the bottom line, and what I try to really offer to my clients through my private sessions and my group workshops, is I want to help other people move out of their fear and out of their pain and really step into their possibility, really get to know who they are on an authentic level, not who they think they should be or who they've been conditioned to be or who they're afraid to be, but who are you and how do we get you into that space in a way that is profound and powerful and really in action. So yeah, there is probably a little est in there. You're very, very perceptive.
I can hear that. Jamie, we're just about out of time. We have to go. Now, website we can find you at.
Yes, please visit www.inspiredhealingandawareness.com.
Okay, and then the other thing is you offer a free consultation.
I absolutely do. I offer a free 20-minute phone consultation. We can do that over the phone. We can also do that via Skype. I work with people all over the country and in other parts of the world, too. So, you know, we've got modern technology, so we can Skype it. We can do it on the phone. And I'd love to be able to have a free consultation with any of your listeners and really help them find where they might be standing in their own way and how they can get out of it.
Oh, I know. Now, by the way, we're about out of time, and I want to thank you for that. I'm going to leave you with this thought. Ask me how I knew John Kappas.
Did you know John Kappas?
No, no, how I knew John Kappas.
Oh, I thought you said if you did. How did you know him?
Funny you should ask that. I taught the basic class there. With that, we got to go. And Jamie, thank you so much for joining us.
Brilliant. Thanks for having me. You are a doll. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. We'll be right back.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Sal Giorgiani with us, a leading pharmacologist, science director for the Men's Health Network. He earned his undergraduate and doctoral degrees from Columbia Union University and is vice chairman of the American Public Health Association Men's Health Section. And let us say, Sal, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on tonight, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we really come down to it, this is Men's Health Month, and the big question here really is, what you say is that American men are less healthier than American women. We're in the same country. We eat the same foods, but for some reason, the women are healthier. Have we come down to a conclusion, Sal, of why this is?
Why is that? Well, there's lots of reasons for it, and part of it is nature, and part of it is nurture, Michael. By nature, men are hunter-gatherers. We see our role as being prepared and bringing, you know, resources to the family, and that means that we're kind of hardwired for the fact that whatever it takes to get that job done, we're just going to do it. So it's kind of the way we're built that we ignore some of the things, such as pain and fatigue and distractions, for the thing that we are hardwired to do, which is provide for our family. And I also think that there's a lot of nurturing here. Society has a very strong role in playing to the men and young boys out there about what their perceptions of health and wellness are and what it is to be a man. One of my students, I taught a class on men's health at a university level, and one of my students pointed out, I said, hey, you know, Dr. G, Maxim and those sorts of magazines, Men's Health magazine, portray what it means to be a man in America these days and what masculinity is. And he's right. We had done a study of advertising for health and health messages for women and young girls versus men and boys in popular magazines. We studied over 7,000 ads, the students and I, and what we found were that health and health-related messages were advertised or promoted to women and young girls almost three times as often as they were for men and young boys. So it's no wonder that there's an anti-health culture that sort of weaves its way through American society now.
Sal, isn't health in and of itself also a state of mind? Is that not a facet of it? You know, it's almost a, if you want to be healthy, it's almost a lifestyle. And if you don't have the lifestyle and if you don't have the state of mind, obviously you're not going to be healthy. You're going to age, and all of these things that we talk about come to fruition.
Oh, sure. We see women from a very young age recognizing that they need to take care of themselves. They are acculturated for it. There are women's health experts out there, and the gynecologists serve as a very important role for women. And women are taught from a very young age that they should be aware of the health, that it's okay to think about the health, that it's fine with the coffee crotch or at the water cooler when they're socializing to talk about their health or health issues. You rarely see that with men. And yeah, it is a state of mind as much as it is a state of physical being.
You know, by the way, my sister lives with me here in the house, and she gets all of these women's magazines and women's health and women's this. And constantly, in every one of the magazines, every once in a while I'll pick them up, it is about women's health, women's health, women's health, which is a great thing. You don't see the same thing with men. You see it, but it's not as prevalent as all of the advertising and the media, the media madness about, you know, lose weight, be healthy, eat this, don't do that. And you don't see that with men. And I'm not quite sure if they think, and it's got to do with money. We both know that the flow of where the dollars are going to come from is what the advertising people are going to move to. But it seems as though men don't get the same that same kind of help that women get when it comes to health.
Yes, that perception applies not only to the media, and one of the axioms in advertising, unfortunately, is that women make healthcare purchasing decisions and men don't. And I think it's kind of a chicken and an egg sort of deal here, where sure. If you don't advertise to men and you don't portray men as being manly, if they think about their health, they're not going to do it. And media is as much a window on society as it is a driver of society's view. But also the way that men and women are taught from a very young age from their families to think about health is suspect as well, or part of the culprit. Men, for example, the first time Johnny falls down, what does he hear? Come on, kid, get up, take it like a man. You hear that analogy running through the sports media as well. When an athlete is playing, he's playing hurt, what do we hear the commentators? They call the hurt athlete a hero, a real athletic, taking one for the team. You very rarely hear that in women's sports. So there is a bias that men don't like to think about health, so therefore the money doesn't flow to them to advertise for them for health. And I think that's got to change.
Also, I think what's happened over the years, the culture. I grew up in a world that exactly what you said is exactly what happened. I remember somebody, they had a friend of mine, we were standing, I was over at his place, and he was up on the roof of the garage, had a golf club in his hand, and I said something to him, and he said, if you say it again, I'm going to throw the club. And I said it again, and he threw the club, and I got hit in the head, and I went home bleeding, and I knocked on the door. I couldn't have been more than 13, 14 years old. I knocked on the door. My mom looked at me, and she said, get in here. She washed it off, threw a Band-Aid on it, and off I was out playing again. Today's world doesn't work that way. We have a different culture and a different sensitivity when it comes to the youngsters. So in essence, if it's going to move that way, it should balance itself out, but it doesn't seem to be doing so.
You're right. And the consequences of this too, Michael, if I could talk about it, they're real consequences. This isn't an academic discussion or just looking at numbers of advertising and advertising dollars, but there are real consequences. In 1920, and this is something that hit it home for me, in 1920, women lived on average 1 year longer than men. In 2008, women live on average 6 years longer than men. So with all the technology and all the access, we're not really making a dent in the way men think about their health and utilize their health. There was a very interesting study that just was released in the middle of June during Men's Health Month from the University of Washington that confirmed some of this data from the federal government. What they found, and this is really going to be, it really should hit the home run here with the guys if they don't think it matters, that in some of the northwest counties of rural Mississippi, the life expectancy for a man there is 66 years old. And with the ages for Social Security pushing now, I think the latest proposal I heard is 67, a lot of men are not going to be collecting even Social Security unless they get their act together. So there are some very significant consequences to this lack of attention to health and lack of view about health as an integral part of living.
Oh, no, absolutely. They're pushing up not only the Social Security, but the retirement age. And that in and of itself can be a major problem for a lot of men if they're not taking care of themselves. And I've watched it, and the amount of the onset of obesity, Sal, in this country is unbelievable, men and women. And you go to the market and you take a look at people, and they're big today.
Yes. This statistic that I quoted for you for Northwest Mississippi, on the other end of the spectrum, if you look at some other counties in Fairfax, Virginia, the life expectancy for the men and women there are much closer together. They're about 81. And when you start peeling away the layers of the onion and try to understand what other co-factors go with this actual death rate, you know, years of life expectancy, it is indeed, as you say, obesity and smoking and lack of exercise. So men have to pay a lot of attention, a lot more attention to that, and they have to instill that into their sons as well.
Well, absolutely. And then when we talk about lack of exercise, somebody does not have to become a gym rat and get down there and, you know.
It's, well, that could be bad for you, too, on the other side. So it's moderate exercise, 30 minutes every couple of days at a minimum, a little bit more if you're totally physically fit and committed, but a minimum. And just walking, just getting out there and going for a walk and going fishing or going hiking or going bowling, something easy but something to do.
Yeah. And I think that's really the key. The there's that old thing about if there's steps in the building, don't take the elevator, take the steps. If that's the only exercise you're going to get, then do that. I already have steps from my basement up to the first floor, and I must do those things 20, 25 times a day, and then I'll do them with every other step. But that's just a lifestyle for me. And then when we get to health, I happen to believe in health a lot. And that in and of itself is going to keep me going for a lot of years ahead. But how do you get someone to do that?
Well, as you said early on, it's a mindset, Michael. You obviously are someone who is very health conscious. You're someone who takes care of themselves. And you've worked it into everything you do. How do you do that? It's got to start at a very young age. And
sure.
I really think one of the things that families have to do with young men, and then even the older guys who haven't been paying attention to themselves, is to let them know that it's that their health is as important to them as a family unit as it is as women's health is. So men have to understand that their families care about their health.
Yeah, now one of the things you say, you know, the grandparents are the secret weapon. I totally, completely believe in that because I happen to be 68 years old and I have no idea what it's like not to work out at least almost every day during the week. But again, it's a mindset. It's a throwback to the way things were and the area that you, the geographic area that you were brought up in, the culture of that particular place. It stays with you.
Yeah, grandfathers. Well, grandparents in general, since it's Men's Health Month and the topic's Men's Health today, talk about granddads. Granddads have a very special role to play in a family unit. Grandfathers are not seen as necessarily disciplinarians, but they are seen as sage, wise individuals. They have wisdom on their side. They have time many times on their side. A lot of granddads still work, but they still have a better perspective on work-life balance. So granddads can really reach their grandsons and their granddaughters in a way that fathers and mothers can't. So sometimes all a grandfather has to do is to spend a little extra time with their grandson, take him fishing, and talking about how this is healthy, how health is important. You would be a wonderful example of talking with your grandson about incorporating exercise in everything you do and as a mindset. It's something that I don't think people appreciate, or certainly a lot of granddads don't appreciate. They have that very, very important role to play.
Well, there's also what's going on in the educational system today. The many of the sports that they can't play anymore, the dodgeballs, the rest of it, somebody might get hit and so on and so forth. And everybody's a winner, quote unquote. There are a lot of kids who excel in sports, but there are kids who I can remember when everybody was involved in some kind of a sport, maybe not going out for the team, quote unquote, but during gym every day, you got a certain amount of exercise, et cetera. Those things are starting to go by the wayside, Sal. They're disappearing very rapidly. And if you don't get that pattern set at an early age, it's very hard to incorporate it into your life later on.
Yeah, almost impossible. Most of your lifestyle habits are set by the time you're about 10 or so these days. And I think that if that habit isn't built in early on, it's harder and harder and harder to build in. But still, the consequences are so significant that young boys need to be reacculturated from what the media portrays. And then older men as well, in their 40s and 50s, they have to take a real close look at the consequences of poor health behaviors. You know, of all the leading causes of disease in the United States, whether it's heart disease or cancers of any kind, not just prostate cancer, but skin cancer, colorectal cancer, injuries, suicides, stroke, men lead women in each one of those dimensions. One of the interesting little side statistics, too, is the fact that I do believe that the economy is hurting the ability for men to stay focused on their health. The economy is leading to some anxiety and enhanced depression in some of the guys, and it's very, very hard when they lose their identity as hunter and gatherers to focus back on their health. So here again, families need to recognize that the consequences of not supporting the older men in their family in viewing health and healthy behaviors in a positive light can be very, very injurious to the family unit.
Well, no question. Sal, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yeah. It's www.menshealthnetwork.org. And on that website, there's a lot of information about what we do from policy, and there's a lot of excellent information and booklets and pamphlets for folks to get there free. And one thing in particular I love to recommend is the Get a Check pamphlet, which is a little booklet that outlines the kinds of tests, exams, vaccinations, and health issues that men need to worry about throughout their lifestyles, life cycles.
Sal, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Thanks very much for having us.
Take care. Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Michael Murdad with us. He is the author of Healing the Heart and Soul, a five-step soul-level healing process for transforming your life. He's a world-renowned spiritual teacher, a healer, and he's an author. He's worked as a healer and counselor for over 30 years now and is the author of the best-selling books, The Seven Initiations of the Spiritual Path, An Introduction to Tantra and Sacred Sexuality, and I love this one, You're Not Crazy, You're Just Waking Up. Michael, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, and thank you for being, I love that title, and it's true, You're Not Crazy, You're Just Waking Up.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Do you find that most people walk through life asleep?
Say that again?
Do you find, are you having trouble hearing me?
Yeah, you're a little bit low in volume.
Okay, let me see if they can amp that up at the network. I'll say a little bit louder. Okay, do you feel that most people are walking around and they're not awake?
Oh, absolutely. And there's different ways of saying it, different authors, different teachers, different teachings have described it differently. Some people say it's almost like a mass hypnosis of life. But basically, yes, people are in a sort of a trance or self-delusion or mass delusion. People have have come to believe that the general flow of things is a reality. We determine our individual lives based on the mass acceptance. Like the old fable where, you know, the king gets these new clothes, where in fact somebody's lying to them, taking advantage of them, stealing money from the king, stitching some clothes together and saying, these clothes are so fine, only, you know, educated or well-bred people can see them. And it actually made everybody delude themselves into being afraid of speaking the truth and instead going with the mass acceptance. And so everybody's just going along with, oh, those are fine clothes. People are doing this every day. When you're not liking your job, and it's time, really, you should be looking for your soul's purpose instead of your job, and you're not liking that job, but people will tell you, oh, no, it's a great job. You're lucky to even have one these days, which jobs are more rare. That's that same behavior, like go along with the program. And I'm not saying we need to be people that are, constantly rude or shaking people's lives up. I'm just saying we have to be more honest and clear. Even if it's in a gentle or subtle way, we have to be more honest and clear. So there's a little child that says, but the emperor is naked. It takes somebody who doesn't know enough about lying and self-deluding to just look out and go, wait, and just kind of call things for what they are. The child means no harm. The child isn't being aggressive or hurtful, but they're calling it for what it is. So when you say, you know, to a partner who you're not communicating with, things aren't going well, but you just sit there in this living death of a relationship, not questioning it, instead of saying, you know, honey, I love that we've been together. I love that certain things about our relationship. We also could amp up this relationship a bit by doing some couples counseling. I mean, do something. Get the ball rolling, something to, you know, change the relationship, your health if it's not well. Anything. I tell folks to rate all categories of your life, your health, finances, relationship, work, and family life, especially those four or five. Health, relationship, family, you know, work, all these things. Rate them 0 to 10 and see where you rate them. You know, a 9... Wow, I mean, that's amazing. An 8, a 9, a 10, that means, even a 7, that means you're doing really well in that category. But when you rate it, like if you're rating relationship, rate all of the things of it. Don't just say, well, we're getting along this week, so I'm going to call it an 8. Rate everything, your communication, your intimacy, and so on. But get an overall perspective. If you can rate a category of your life, work, whatever it happens to be, 7, 8, 9, 10, I think it's a blessing. Give thanks for it and really enjoy it. And maybe continue working on it, but enjoy it. If you rate anything in your life as a 6 or a 5, that means there's probably a little bit of an alarm there where you probably need to start working on it, but you're not yet in the danger zone. If you rate any category of your life as a 4 or less, it means it is suspect and it is subject to be dismantled. That it means that human beings have not only a conscious intelligence, but a subconscious intelligence, which very few people understand or know thoroughly. But we have a subconscious intelligence. We actually have a, like computers, where you have programs that are running only when you call them up and see them, and you also have programs running in your computer that you do not see, but they are doing effective things. They are actually doing active work, even though you're not seeing them. Well, our subconscious is also active out there, and it's actually working not only in your body, as it were. It actually has frequency and intelligence to communicate to other beings around us, you know, whether it's animals. You know, we know that animals respond to us in consciousness, but clearly so do people. And so people are picking up the fact that you're not doing very well in this area of your life. In the world, the people in the world, everything around you will respond. And if you're a 3 in your relationship, the world, the universe, or even your soul is going to find some way to pull the rug out of that area of your life because it wants you to improve your life. It's almost like calling it a spiritual survival of the fittest. It's like a selection process, but spiritually instead of just biologically. It's part of the selection process. Your soul wants you to improve, and when you're not, it's going to kill some part of your life to get you to become stronger. It'll get you out of a job, and you'll think it's the boss that fired you, but it'll be a subconscious message you sent to the boss that said, I can't do this anymore. Your partner might cheat or leave on you, but you also are playing a part. And it's not right that they do it, but you're playing a part by not getting active work done in the relationship. So the universe is like this, and yes, it is amazing that it's on this delusion or illusion that the copacetic, everything's copacetic as long as you don't question anything. But if you don't question it and it starts to rate low, something's going to go horribly wrong, and you're going to then feel like and look like a victim in it. And you will, it will feel that way because things are going to be hurtful when they happen. But you have an option. You can say, now I see something's not working and I'm going to make it change. And that's why a lot of that is in the You're Not Going Crazy, You're Just Waking Up book. But what to do about it and the process of healing these issues is more in the latter book, the book that just came out a couple weeks ago, which is Healing the Heart and Soul.
Now, by the way, let me respond to a couple things that you've said. The child speaking. There's power in innocence because those speak. They speak without the judgment they're concerned about that an adult would be. So there's very much. There's a lot of strength in what the little ones will say. But being asleep is a very interesting thing. Being asleep can be a mask because we're frightened to death of being who we are. Living death in the relationship is also a mask, and it's a protection so you don't have to stand outside of yourself and get into the world that you're not really sure of. And with somebody cheating on you and leaving you, it is right that they do that because that's all part of that challenge and that unconscious motivation to say, take a look at your life. Because if it's going along average and you're and nothing happens, you don't have any peaks and valleys, you can live that life and you're never going to recognize who you are. Every challenge, there's a gift. There's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow if you look through it. And the end result of every challenge is a legacy you leave if you're smart enough to get it.
That's right. And like you said, the pot of gold. When you make the changes, as scary and intimidating as they may have seemed, when you just saw symptoms of a problem, then you got on the ball and you made some changes. When we do that, it's incredible because we usually end up saying, I should have done it sooner. And yet, I just had a client leave minutes before we did this program, just minutes ago, my last client, and this person is saying they're in a relationship for 20 years with almost no communication, connection. Intimacy was gone years ago, and they both know it, but they're sitting in the same household. They don't have children tying them together or anything else other than codependence and delusion. So it's amazing. 20 years. And, you know, you can do a lot in 20 years. There are people on planet Earth that changed the whole world in a couple of years.
Sure.
And you have 20 years that clicked by, and you're only doing it because, and in talking to them, they came to understand mainly fear. Fear of hurting the partner's feeling, fear of what they were going to do if they did leave. Fear, it doesn't matter. And it to be paralyzed by one's fears will do you nothing. It'll absolutely serve no purpose at all. It'll only keep you paralyzed. Mind you, there's a purpose to it in the sense that you can learn a lesson from it, of course. But I'm trying to get people to understand more and more in the materials I've written. You're always learning. You're always getting to become a better person somehow, but it's always done the easy way or the hard way. And I'm only recommending that we get on the ball and try the easy way a little more often. I'm not saying judging like good or bad or anything like that. I'm just calling it easy way and hard way. Even when you learn lessons the hard way, you're still learning them, fortunately. But we could choose the easy way, and the easy way would mean listen to the signs, synchronicities, you know, whatnot that's happening around us, and then, not just listening to them, integrate what they're trying to tell us and act upon.